The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. So it was all true about football being nothing without fans. From the noise at Brentford as the Bees saw Arsenal off with ease, all the way to the Spurs fans asking if Harry Kane was watching as Heung-min Son defeated the champions. And in between, Trevor Chalobah's surprise celebration, Paul Pogba's absolute brilliance, the Newcastle roar after 5 minutes, the Newcastle boos after 90, Goodison forgetting all of that history after Rafa's win over Southampton, all that plus the important stuff, Graham Potter's beard, Jurgen Klopp's lack of spectacles, and an interesting fact about Burnley. We'll look back at the life of Gert Müller, there's an old TV appearance from Wilson, some life advice for me, and a new academic qualification for Barry. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, hello.
How are you doing?
Marvellous, thank you very much. Paul McInnes, welcome.
Thanks, Max. Nice to see you.
It's nice to see you. You're sitting on the floor.
That's right, because I have no furniture.
Okay.
I mean, I do. I have one chair, but it's been ravaged by a cat, which means that if you were to sit on it, your ass could fall through it. So,
oh, really?
Staying clear.
Okay. Would you like listeners to send you furniture?
Yeah, I kind of would. I mean, if it was tasteful.
Okay. Look, if anybody has anything going, if you could suggest it, then over the season, we can build up.
Send pictures first, maybe, rather than just sort of dumping them out.
That's
like
not how it
fly
works.
Tipping in the middle of the night.
It is literally whatever you've got. Send it to Paul McInnes. I'll tweet out his address, and we'll see what you've got by the end of the season. Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello.
Paul, fans being back, and it's obvious, isn't it, that it's better, and it just felt better, and whether you went or you were watching on the TV. But it's still worth repeating how great, just from the moment Friday night and Brentford, especially the way the game went, all the way to Sunday, it was really heartwarming.
Yeah, it was incredible. It was incredible. I mean, I think it's the best weekend of Premier League football I can remember, which doesn't mean the best one ever. But, and it was almost exclusively because of the fans, not just because they were there. Although, you know, you could hear the crackle. I didn't get to go to any games. On the telly, you could feel it. You could hear the noise, feel the crackle. Some of the scenes, the Leeds 1-1 situation was just looked like chaos in Old Trafford. It was incredible. But it had such an effect, a noticeable effect on football. I mean, I think that was the greatest thing about it. You could tell that the energy, and it was almost exclusively positive energy, was being transferred from the crowd to the players, and they responded with, you know, great football across the piece.
It crossed my mind, like, there are quite a few young players who have a season of Premier League or Championship or League One, League Two football under their belts, who this season are playing in front of large crowds for the very first time, and it must be kind of weird for them, and it may affect different players in different ways and different teams in different ways. It'll be interesting to see.
Wilson, you were at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. It's a good place to start. The champions losing. Only the third time that's happened ever in Premier League history. Chelsea lost in 2017 to Burnley and Leicester to Hull before Spurs fans start getting carried away that they're going to win the league. But what was the atmosphere like?
It was really, really, really good. It's the first time I've been to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium with fans in it. I was especially that last sort of 10 minutes or so when every challenge was being roared. And it felt incredibly loud. Now, I don't know if that just means that the acoustics of that stadium are excellent or whether I just forgotten what it was like. But I think the press box is on the opposite side to the camera. But the away to my right, so the stand's one big tier, which is 17,000 capacity, I think, that stand. From there, like every tackle in that last few minutes, you know, when the noise is so loud, you get that sort of distortion in your ear. That was happening. Now, maybe that happens all the time. You just forget about it at football, but it felt really special. And of course, the glee that Harry Kane was with the Harry Kane situation was very funny, to be honest. I had a very good afternoon. I really enjoyed it.
Dave says, which fans have overreacted the most to one game? And Simon says, when's the open top bus parade for Spurs title win? And will Max come back from Australia for it? I mean, Barry, City were not at it. But, and I'm Spurs biased, I thought that was a brilliant, spirited, tough, disciplined performance from Tottenham.
Yeah, you're certainly right. The City weren't at it. But you have to give Spurs plenty of credit. They sat back and let City sort of do their dance in front of them, stayed well organised, and then broke with lightning speed on several occasions. And it was from one of those breaks that Son scored his goal for the second time in or second game in a row. I would be pointing my big finger of blame at Nathan Ake to a certain extent. I just don't think he's good enough for City. But yeah, Spurs, their work ethic was tremendous. Their defending was excellent. Jaffa Tanganga is rightly getting plaudits for containing not just Raheem Sterling, but Raheem Sterling and Jack Grealish, who didn't have a particularly good game on his league debut for City. And I must confess, I did not think Spurs had a hope in hell of winning this game or getting anything out of it. So I was very surprised.
I mean, I certainly didn't after the first 15 minutes.
Well, no.
I really thought Spurs actually wouldn't touch a ball until next weekend. But after that start, Paul, actually, City didn't really create that much either. And Tottenham had the better chances.
Yeah, they certainly had the better moments, I think. I was struggling to think of a comparison of a game where there were so many effective counter-attacking moves from one team. I mean, effective to an extent, quite a lot of the time they didn't get the ball into the sort of the right position for a shot. But the number of times they advanced from, you know, their edge of their own box or halfway inside that half to the edge of the City box in a couple of seconds was quite striking. Statistically speaking, I think City did have the two biggest chances of the game, you know, XG-wise. I think there was the Mahrez effort, which he sort of blazed over, and then Ferran Torres just completely sort of doing nothing with a sort of back post effort that was 6 yards out. And I think the conclusion I came to from that is that they just sort of managed, City have managed to put £20 million onto Harry Kane's price tag because the absence was that glaring for them.
Would you go along with that, Wilson?
Yeah, I think, well, I don't know about Harry Kane. I think that's a complex situation which I don't really understand. But what I found interesting during the game was, I assume City won it on XG. But I think it's where you see XG falls down, that after 20 minutes, City were brilliant. And after 20 minutes, it could have been 3-0. But when it wasn't, my sense was, Spurs are going to nick this. And okay, that's a sense that maybe would only come true 30 or 40% of the time. But there was a weird sort of timidity, diffidence to City. So even though they had loads of the ball, even though they had loads of crossing opportunities, even though they must have had more shots than Spurs, although Spurs, I suspect, caught up in the second half, I never really had a sense after about 25, 30 minutes that City were going to win the game. Once Spurs had gone ahead, which wasn't a shock, and particularly the way it came wasn't a shock. The fact that it came from a break, and particularly a break down the Spurs right, because I thought Mendy and Ake between them, I mean, that's got, you know, one-way ticket to Lommel written all over it. They were awful. Once they'd scored, I couldn't really see City getting back into it. And you know, when you write your match report and you have to fire that on the whistle, there comes a point in the game where you have to make a call on what you think is going to happen, because you have to write your intro. And you're then praying that nothing changes. And often, I'd leave that to sort of the 85th minute. But here, I think I wrote it after 70 minutes because I had no real expectation of City scoring. And that is oddly like the Champions League final.
I think the one exception in the game, when I agreed totally with what Jonathan's saying, the one exception was when Kevin De Bruyne got on the ball. Now, he only had a kind of short cameo at the end, and he is obviously he is one of the best players in the league, one of City's best players, so he would make a difference. But I thought it was also telling, really, that he was the only guy who really had the attitude, the right attitude, whatever combination that is, to get on the ball and try and dominate the game, try and influence the outcome of the game. Whereas a lot of City's stars, you know, big price tag players were absent in that regard.
I mean, a lot of the worst are literally absent as well. We should say that this is not a first choice City team. And clearly, a lot of the players he played were not fully, you know, up to speed. And the De Bruyne thing, when he came off the bench with, what was that, 80 minutes, something like that?
Yeah.
I did sort of think, oh Christ, this is I've seen this narrative before as well.
Yeah.
But thankfully, thankfully for my match report, that didn't happen.
And that's what matters, obviously.
As you say, as you said on Thursday night, I'm a sociopath. I don't really care anything outside my own world. And yes, I was very happy with my match report. I didn't even want a second Tottenham goal because then I've had to lose my riff about Jack Grealish, and I didn't want to lose that. I was pleased with that. I was happy with it.
What was your Jack Grealish riff?
Well, last season he was fouled 4.2 times per game, way, way more than anybody else. So I think second in that list was Wilfried Zaha on 2.9. But I think, 4.2 times per game. I think there are only five players in total were fouled more than 2.1 times per game. So Grealish is getting fouled twice as often as anybody else in the league. And I think the expectation had been, well, at City, that won't happen as much because he won't be the creative focus to the same extent. He got fouled four times in the first half alone, once in the second half, so five times. But the other thing about him is he's really good at getting fouled. He's not just a great drawer of fouls, but a drawer of great fouls.
Ah, very good.
Yeah, no, I was pleased with it. I was happy. Yeah, yeah. And such a range. You know, he's got the sort of, look, ref, I've been fouled, but I'm stumbling on. Oh, no, I'm in the box. I've fallen over. Foul. He's got the kind of flipping himself in the air when somebody touches his ankle. Foul. He's got the staying on his feet, limping away, dragging his calf behind him because he's been touched on the calf. Foul. And then, you know, this master of being fouled, this great highlighter of fouls. I mean, it must be fantastic. Yeah, him in training against Fernandinho, that's like matter and antimatter coming together. The great disguiser of fouls against the great exposer of fouls. I mean, I would love to see that. And then in injury time, he has the temerity, the rank hypocrisy, and it was beautiful to see the effrontery of it, to accuse Lucas Moura going down easily after he's absolutely slashed him off at the ankles. Beautiful to see. I love hypocrisy in football. It's great.
Samuel says, which was funnier, Grealish complaining about someone going down easily or Fernandinho complaining about someone not getting booked for persistent foul? Gary Neville said in commentary, Mendy can't defend. And you mentioned Ake as well. And, you know, it is interesting. I think that was the most expensive Premier League starting 11 ever put out on a pitch and the most expensive bench ever as well. How have they ended up with, you know, a centre-back, a left-sided centre-back and a left-back who aren't amazingly brilliant at football?
Well, I remember when Jordan Henderson left Sunderland and went to Liverpool, I think he cost 14 million, which at the time people were thought was a ridiculous amount of money to pay for this guy who hadn't done much. And Kenny Dalglish, who brought him to Liverpool, said, you know, we are paying for the potential. And my, what potential that turned out to be. I suspect when, I can't remember how much City paid for Ake and Mendy individually, but it's presumably a lot of money. I suspect you're paying a lot for potential there as well. And that potential hasn't yet been fulfilled. I quite like Mendy as a character. I've seen him have good games, but he didn't have one yesterday, and neither did Ake. I don't think I've ever seen Ake have a good game for City, but then he hasn't played for them very often.
Very expensive signings don't actually work very often. So if you look at the top 10, 12 signings of all time, there's very few of them you could say are absolutely definitively a success. So your name out of PSG, I mean, he's obviously a really good player, but they haven't won the Champions League yet. Mbappe to PSG, the same. Coutinho to Barcelona, disaster. João Félix to Atletico, hasn't really worked yet. Griezmann to Barcelona, failure so far. Grealish to City, we'll see. Lukaku to Chelsea, we'll see. Dembele to Barcelona, disaster. Pogba to Manchester United, still in the balance. Hazard to Real Madrid, hasn't worked yet. Ronaldo to Juventus, okay, scored loads of goals in the league, but they haven't won the Champions League, and they now have massive financial problems. Bale to Real Madrid, well, yeah, okay, four Champions Leagues, but it hasn't exactly been happy.
That's
so big money
point.
Doesn't necessarily work.
James says Do you think Alexander Zinchenko will regret missing the birth of his first child for that? That was a to come on very late for a terrible Mendy performance. And PhD Ocean saying, why should Spurs sell Kane to a club who's only out of the bottom three on goal difference? Look, we'll see what happens with the Harry Kane situation. You mentioned Pogba there. Let's talk about his brilliance. Man United beat Leeds 5-1. And Paul, he was sensational yesterday. 4 assists. Only 7 players have done that before in the Premier League. And he was just he's a joy, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. I mean, he can do things and see things that people can't, and it's that I don't think that's said enough about him. Actually, you know, as a schemer, as somebody who can unlock things on the pitch, he is, you know, he has it. He's elite in that regard. The conundrum with Pogba is well established, and I think Graham Souness had another chip at it at the weekend, so you know, probably don't need to go there. I just think that, you know, the assists were beautiful to watch. They felt very united. I thought one of the things about the performance against Leeds was that it felt very Manchester United. There was a lot of flair sort of, you know, bubbling near to the surface whenever they were on the ball. They wanted to play with character, and I thought that was good. But probably as much as anything, because I think there were a couple of moments defensively where you're like, oh, what about Pogba? But there was also a moment in the game where he managed to sort of just inside the centre circle, get on top of a loose ball with about 3 men around him, hold one off, spin the other, and then with a third touch, you know, release a pass down the field. And that was the sort of thing that I think Pogba can do that nobody else can do, is knit all those things together. And to see that, I think if you're a United fan, that's what would really get you excited, because he needs to come backwards as well as go forwards. But, you know, when he was going forwards, he was superlative.
I mean, it's worth pointing out that he got 4 assists yesterday, which is more assists than he got in the whole of last season. Haldor says, back in December, Barry declared Bielsa a definitively better manager than Solskjaer. By how much would Man United be beating Leeds if the two teams swapped coaches? Simon, Pat and Evan said Solskjaer out-tacticked Bielsa on Saturday. Can we have Wilson's thoughts on this, given he and others have been quite vocal in their criticism of Solskjaer's tactical nous compared to the elite managers?
Well, it's a 4-goal win, the same as it was last season for United at home over Leeds. And I think, actually, the problems were slightly more worrying, I think, for Leeds this time. Because Leeds is pressing is man-to-man. So if you have a team that whose movement is very good, and particularly when they're then passing very well within that, you know, they can expose Bielsa's sides. And so Bielsa's sides, every now and again, they have a huge defeat. And what I thought was really impressive about United here was obviously Pogba's individual performance and Fernandes' individual performance. But from a tactical point of view, was the movement of Greenwood. Now, I don't know if the plan is to use him at centre-forward regularly or whether Cavani will come in as soon as he's available. But him sort of dropping deep and pulling out to the left allowed Pogba to go into that space and allowed Fernandes to go into that space. And Leeds really, really struggled to deal with that. Now, obviously, when Rashford is back, he will play on that left side and he will be able to exploit that space going inside if Greenwood is that sort of free number nine. So I think, from an attacking point of view, that's really encouraging for United. Having said that, I think it's a way of playing that is particularly effective against a team like Leeds, and whether that will be as effective against a team who has a more sort of solid flat back four, maybe not, we'll see. But as a start, you know, it's incredibly impressive, and obviously, you know, players to come in.
What I would say is that it's important to remember most of that Leeds team were playing Championship football 2 seasons ago. Manchester United have better players than Leeds do, so they should beat Leeds. But Calvin Phillips was a very conspicuous absence in the front of the Leeds defence. I'm not saying they would have won if he'd been there, but Robin Koch was brought in his place, not his natural position, and he just could not cope at all. And because of that, Bruno Fernandes had the freedom of the pitch. None of his runs were being tracked. And he had a wonderful game. I watching the game, I thought Manchester United sort of took Leeds on at their own game and beat them at it.
An interesting point, Wilson, about lots of people saying when Varane comes in, he was unveiled before the game, that Man United can ditch one of Fred or McTominay, and probably Fred. I think even Fred was trending because he scored a goal. But actually, does that doesn't seem tactically sensible to my mind. You know, you've got a, just because you've got a good back four doesn't mean you don't need holding midfielders like that.
No, I would agree. I mean, obviously, if you have more faith in your back four, then you can take more risks further upfield. But I think the basic structure will remain the same. I think against teams who sit very deep against United, who look to frustrate them, then maybe you can risk playing Pogba as one of the two with license to push on, which is how he played for France when they won the World Cup. So it's not that he can't do that. It's just like, I have a slight soonest issue with Pogba that I wouldn't necessarily trust him defensively over 90 minutes, which you saw against Switzerland in the Euros. I would agree. I think there's nothing wrong with playing two holders. Playing two holders doesn't make you defensive because that can liberate other players. I think it's a very basic understanding of tactics to say, oh, back four is good, therefore we can play more attacking players. I just don't think football works as basically as that.
Andrew says, with Leeds fans now travelling to a town near you, are we still everyone's favourite second team? There were some young louts, weren't there, of Leeds and Manchester United hitting each other with bins. It's always like, it's always filmed from someone just having a latte, looking out the window going, what are these idiots doing? Anyway, let's go to the Brentford Community Stadium then. The first game of the season, Brentford 2, Arsenal 0. Mark says, with Arsenal rising 3 places in just 2 days, how can anybody say Arteta isn't making progress? But as you called it...
Yeah, and I don't think it was a particularly bold call to make. I fully expected Arsenal to lose. They didn't let me down. It's interestingly, and I don't think this section should be about Arsenal's failings. It should be about Brentford's excellence on their long overdue return to the Premier League. But the one thing I would say is that I think I saw Emmanuel Petit was working as a pundit on some foreign TV station over the weekend, and he said he just doesn't really feel anything about Arsenal anymore. They don't do anything to interest him. And I said the same towards the end of last season, and I can't see that changing anytime soon. They're just monotonously, predictably bad, and they're boring. And if I was a fan of theirs, I'd be very dispirited.
I always think, Paul, it's, at the level of football I play, the team who wants it more quite often will just win, right? But I sort of think at elite level, that shouldn't be a thing. Whereas you saw it at Spurs, you felt Spurs wanted that more than City. And like Brentford wanted it more, encapsulated by what I would say is footballing heaven, that second goal.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised. I mean, it's probably just my ignorance, really. But whenever I've watched Brentford in the Championship, I thought, they're a pretty progressive, possession-based team who move the ball through the thirds, advance the ball from centre half, that sort of thing, and regularly play with a back four. When I've seen them, it's a back three, direct play, some big lumps, and then a very well rehearsed long throw routine that involves a double screen at the front post and late arrivals at the back to fill the vacated space. And that's impressive to me, because I think in the Premier League, whatever your style and your philosophy, I think you need to play horses for courses sometimes. And Arsenal have a soft underbelly, that is no secret. And you might be well served to try and take advantage of that.
Yeah, I think you make a good point, actually, because and you'll know better than me, Paul, you've seen much more of Brentford play, but if they can mix it up, because they will come up against centre-backs who can head it. And like Ben White, I don't think he won any. I mean, and it's hard. I know he's been called out because he had just been bought for a lot of money and none of their defence played well. But like every time the ball was not long to Tony on Mbeumo, they just won the ball in the air. They won the second ball as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's another sort of thing about a badly organised team or a team that isn't in the right space in terms of attitude. It makes good players look bad. And, obviously he's relatively new in the door, and the understanding between the players will need to improve. But, you know, you don't get a sense from watching Arsenal that they have a philosophy and identity and they know what they're doing, you know, with their eyes closed. And I think that makes a difference. And I think it was impressive to see that Brentford, to, you know, qualify from what I've seen, don't regularly play that way, were so, you know, ready to go with that approach. I think that reflects well on what they've done over the summer.
Do you say Arsenal in crisis, Wilson?
I think you would say that if it hadn't been so predictable. I'd sort of slightly annoyed with myself because I had exactly the same inclination as Barry that Brentford would win. And then they allowed the rational part of my brain to take over, go, no, but look at the players they have, Arsenal, a better side. Yeah. So the predictions thing I do on a different podcast, you know, I had Arsenal to win it 2-1. But within 5 minutes of the start of that game, it was obvious Brentford were going to win it. And it's that sort of just limpness, the gutlessness of Arsenal. And you know, the point you make about wanting it more, I think often it can look like a team doesn't care or isn't trying as hard if things go tactically wrong, because they're just in the wrong position. So they're not there to make the tackles, or they're not there to make the runs. But here I think it is a mental thing or an application thing that it just felt like they didn't win any challenges, that they had no gumption, no imagination. I mean, there's that one shot early in the second half that the keeper made a good save down to his right. And apart from that, they just didn't threaten. And then the second goal sort of felt like it would arrive eventually. And which makes it sound like it wasn't a sort of fantastic spectacle. But it was, because it was Brentford and it was their first game in the Premier League, first game in the top flight for 75 years. And the atmosphere there did look amazing. And those scenes at the end, yeah, I know people go, oh, yeah, looks like they've won the league. Yeah, but it's their first game back. If you can't celebrate that, you can't celebrate anything. And, you know, the old bloke with the tears glistening on his cheeks, the kid that Thomas Frank went over to, that was all, it's all brilliant stuff.
I mean, what even constitutes a crisis for Arsenal anymore? Nobody expects them to win the league. I don't think many people expect them to trouble the top four. So what is a crisis for Arsenal? Ninth, 10th, 11th? Relegation? They're too good to be relegated. So I think this is just kind of par at this stage.
Okay, I think you're right. I think let's wait until Arsenal are 15th and then we can announce it is a crisis for Arsenal. Anything above 15th is just okay.
I mean, they do have Aubameyang and Lacazette to come back.
Yeah.
And that obviously will make a difference. I mean, I felt a bit sorry for Balogun, who, you know, had an awful game, but he's a kid being dropped into an incredibly difficult situation. But I think pretty quickly, I mean, we're sort of joking about this at Arsenal, sort of in perpetual crisis, but I think sort of if there's not significant signs of the tanker being turned around within sort of 10, 12 games, the sort of the criticism of Arteta has always been, had a caveat attached of, it's a really difficult job, it's going to take time to turn it around. But at some point, people are going to start saying, well, is this ever going to get turned around? And I think a third of the way into the season, Arteta could be in a bit of trouble.
Is it the case that nobody could turn this around for Arsenal now? Because there does appear to be, you know, it sucked out of the life from Emery, didn't it? And you know, we've seen whatever his preferred style of football. He's a great manager. Is it to do with Arteta here? He's the wrong man for the job, or is it just that there is some sort of juju in the Arsenal stadium that means that it can't be fixed?
Well, I think there's a couple of things there. So one is Emery is a great coach in Spain.
Right.
You know, he didn't work from Spartak, didn't work from particularly a PSG. So whether his methods need a Spanish environment, players who by and large speak Spanish, that could be an issue. But clearly he is a very, very gifted manager and it didn't work from there. I think Arteta seems very sort of isolated. I don't really see any support for him. You hear things from within the club that a bit like Guardiola, he wants to be involved in everything. He's very, very intense. And when results aren't going well, that can rub people up the wrong way. So I sort of want to believe Arteta's a good coach because he seems to have everything that should make him a good coach. He's an intelligent player. He had a great grounding working with Pep. But the evidence is pretty limited so far that he is good. I mean, I know they finished last season very well. But yeah, that tanker needs to get turned around pretty quickly, or he's going to have to find another tanker to captain.
And that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll go to the other Premier League games. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, if you missed the live show on Thursday, you can still get a ticket and watch it. You have to get a ticket by Tuesday evening, I think it is. You go to theguardian.com/guardianlive. I'll read you two tweets to tease as to why you might want to. One from Max: I'm still astonished by what Eau Claire revealed in the first half. What a guy. And two from David: the worrying bit is that no one was surprised that Barry mentioned either of those things. So you have to get a ticket if you want to find out what they are. I was surprised. Mike says, given I'm yet to read or hear a season preview that doesn't have Watford relegated, was it rather unsporting of us not to simply accept our fate and instead take points off proper Premier League club Aston Villa? Watford 3, Villa 2. I predicted Watford would finish bottom. But they were excellent. I mean, especially on the break. I thought they played so well.
I'll put my hands up on coming from highlights here. So, but I did watch enough of Watford last season with a degree of envy as a Norwich supporter, and they beat us home and away last year. Thought, you know, they do have a Premier League approach. They do have a style of play that is suited in the Premier League. They have real athleticism throughout the team. They have pace out wide. They have strength in the middle. And, you know, I thought from what I saw of Emmanuel Dennis, you know, he appeared to be the right sort of answer. He appeared to have the offerings of an answer for that position they needed, because I think they were a bit short centre forward. João Pedro played well, didn't score an awful lot of goals. If this guy looks like a poacher, if that's the case, that's what they needed to, I think, more than anything else in that team. So, you know, again, they benefited from supporters, home supporters, a good crowd at Vicarage Road. They always get behind the team. So I think that will have helped. But yeah, they were aggressive, they were decisive, they were assertive. And you know, that against a Villa side, you know, some good signings, but they're going to have to build again, really, because it is going to require significant change from what they were doing last season. You know, I think they Watford took advantage.
Juan Hernandez, the first Colombian to score on his Premier League debut, Barry, and how?
Sorry, I'm just trying to remember the goal. Yes,
that non-memorable strike from Juan Hernandez. That one we'll remember for literally one day and then have totally forgotten.
It was a long time ago, Max. It was Saturday. Almost 2 days ago.
Do you want me to remind you what it was?
I do remember it. Yeah. Okay. So it's his first appearance for Watford. I mean, I think he's been there a long time, but constantly loaned out elsewhere. Beat Emi Buendia and on the edge of the area and curled the shot in off the post. And yeah, wonderful strike. This score, there was some couple of cracking goals in that game. I was hugely impressed with Ismail Assar, who Watford have, I suppose, done well to hold on to. But I mean, Matt Targett's had a good season last year. He's a good fullback, and he got a roasting he'll never forget in the first half. So bad that he was hauled off at half time. You know, people often envy footballers and say, I would love to be a footballer. But just looking at Matt Targett chasing forlornly as Sarr just whizzed past him time after time after time, I did not envy him one bit. It was a very chastening afternoon for him.
Newcastle West Ham, Newcastle 2, West Ham 4. I thought this was a great game, Wilson. I thought both teams really contributed, and it could have gone either way.
Yeah, and then I guess the penalty was decisive, and whether you think that was a penalty or not, I guess depends on you.
I don't think anything. I don't know anyone thought that was a penalty. I mean, it was an interesting weekend, wasn't it? With the fact that actually refereeing seemed to be much better, or much, it's how football used to be, so everyone liked it.
Yeah, it felt more natural. But yeah, I mean, I like the line, the first goal where Saint-Maximin sort of turns back and forth, and I very much like the line of Vatishan Handaraja from the Independent, who said he turned him so often rice became risotto.
Oh, very good. Paul?
Yeah, I was just gonna make a brief comment on VAR, because you know, you're right there. I think it was striking, and this is what the PGAML, the referees body, the Premier League want. They've taken the lesson from the Euros. They think that people want less intervention and to allow the game to flow and give the margin, you know, give the benefit of the doubt to the attacker, etc. Go away from simulation, winning penalties in the box. But then I think with that Jacob Murphy challenge, I think you'll see this is the flip side of what's going to happen because of that change. Is that, you know, the referee might miss that because it did look like there was there was contact, but it came after he won the ball. So the referee could miss that, but the VAR not intervening to say, we think this is an actual serious error, or you should go and look at the monitor to make your own mind up, is perhaps what the outcome of being told, you know, keep away, let the referee. So it's unfortunate, because I think that was definitely a decision that should have been overturned. However, and it's unfortunate on a weekend of good refereeing, good VAR, we get that. At the same time, I think within the broader context of the match, I think West Ham were on top and would have scored anyway.
It did give us the chance to hear, for the first time this season, a manager saying, as Steve Bruce said, you know, why can't Martin or whichever referee look at the screen rather than someone 300 miles away? I know that all the managers know exactly how far Stockley Park is away from the game they're currently at. Barry?
I thought it was an interesting game from a Newcastle perspective. It was kind of like a perfect storm for them. Newcastle fans constantly tell us they're not after titles or Champions League. They want to see players trying. They want to be entertained. And I think Newcastle's players did try, and it was a very entertaining game. And Newcastle contributed to that in no small part. They took the lead twice, ultimately lost. And at the end of the match, they got booed off. And I was wondering, what exactly are these fans booing here? You know, they made a decent effort. It was an entertaining game. Were they booing the score? Were they booing the players? Were they booing the manager? Was it a retrospective boo for all the booing they couldn't do last season that they wanted to do? I honestly don't know what they were booing.
Well, they did beat West Ham twice last season. So this is a significantly worse result than that. And yeah, you know, they've made one signing this summer, and I think they would think they need to make more than that, and if they don't, that kind of result will happen more often.
They flattered to deceive in the game as well. You know, they had a couple of 15-minute spells when they were really on top, but you know, their only real sort of plan was get the ball to Saint-Maximin wherever he was, and you know, I think West Ham did very well at, you know, forcing him back down the pitch. Soufal closed him down, you know, effectively second half. So they didn't really have anything else. So whereas West Ham looked like they knew what they were doing all the way through the game.
Antonio has now equaled Paolo Di Canio as West Ham's leading Premier League goal scorer. Do you want to guess what the West Ham Premier League goal scoring record is?
48?
57.
It is 47. I mean, that is miserable, isn't it? Like, that is rubbish. You know, it's extraordinary. I know West Ham haven't been in the Premier League every year of the Premier League. You'd hope just Mark Noble surely had that many penalties, hasn't he?
He's like second top scorer, isn't he, Mark Noble, for them? You know, I mean, that is indicative of where they're at.
Let's go to Carrow Road, Norwich 0, Liverpool 3. Paul, as a Norwich fan, Paul, there is this cliche that Norwich are a nice side to play against. From one game this season and from my entire knowledge of watching Norwich, that really seems quite true.
I was waiting. What's he going to say? Quite inaccurate. Quite wrong. No, yeah. Quite true. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of Norwich fans who watched the game came away kind of like reasonably okay about it, because we'd had this terrible COVID preseason. you know, Grant Hanley hadn't played any minutes the pre-season, Timo Pukki had barely, that sort of thing. And we put together a performance that at times looked composed. But then watching the, I thought the Shearer analysis on Match of the Day was really telling. I mean, he was just even sort of like, he wasn't even verbally addressing some of the mistakes. He was just highlighting them on the screen and then moving on because there was so much to talk about. Basically, every goal had something rookie wrong in it. And that is very, very familiar from last time in the Premier League.
And were those rookie, were there rookie mistakes in the Championship as well? Or is that, but that just, you were just better, you had better, you know, the opposition aren't as good?
No, I mean, I do think that last time in the Championship, we were better organised defensively and we were, you know, we the sort of times where we gave up mistakes were when we were coasting in games, apart from when we played Watford. And I said sort of a few minutes ago, I think Watford are a Premier League template in the Championship. And whenever we played them, we sort of got found out a little bit. And, you know, Ben Gibson made a real difference for Norwich last season. I won't go on about Norwich, sorry. But, like, Ben Gibson made a real difference for Norwich last season. And it was him who stepped out, broke the defensive line for some reason. You know, back four that, despite COVID, do know each other. And allowed Jota the space to slip in so that when that really unlucky deflection happened, he was there and we weren't. And so, yeah, it was concerning.
Mo Salah, the first player to score in the opening game of the season 5 times in a row. Van Dijk back. I mean, Wilson, I still think, we said in the Premier League preview, I think it's interesting how little people have discussed Liverpool, mainly because they haven't been super active in the transfer market.
Yeah, but I think there's justifiable concerns about the forward line, that Firmino and Mane last season had poor seasons. And the fact that the age they are, which is 29, I think, they're at an age when players can, I mean, maybe not so much these days, but you sort of think as they approach 30, have they lost a little bit of hunger, lost a little bit of sharpness? So, yeah, Firmino getting his goal maybe is a useful thing for him to sort of build confidence. So, you know, I think Liverpool on their day, you can be really good. And if they play as well as they did 2 years ago, of course they'll be in the title race. But I think there's reasons to be sceptical as to whether they can do that and whether they have the squad depth to sustain a challenge.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out about Billy Gilmour getting alleged homophobic abuse from the Liverpool fans, a section of them during the game. Cop Outs, which is the LGBT fan group, tweeted, "Great result today, marred by homophobic chanting by some of our players targeting Chelsea loanee Billy Gilmour. If you can't support without resorting to bigoted nonsense, you don't understand. You'll never walk alone." Liverpool also tweeted, "The chant is offensive and inappropriate, a message we've repeatedly communicated alongside Cop Outs. We urge supporters to remember the inclusive values of the club and to refrain from using it in the future." And actually, at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, there was that incident after the game, Wilson, where...
Yeah, no, I have to say, I didn't see this, but what there appears to have been some kind of disruption around a rainbow flag, a Tottenham flag, that some City fans have been accused of trying to pull down. Now, as I say, I did not see it, so I don't know the truth of that, but if that is what happened, then obviously that's very concerning as well.
Yeah, agree. Let's go to Stamford Bridge, Chelsea 3, Palace 0. And Paul, that wonderful moment when Trevor Chalobah scored. I mean, it might be the moment of the weekend, wasn't it? Because he ran off going, "I've just scored a goal," and then he realised the enormity of it like half a second later.
Yeah, I think it was beautiful, and there's just something, I don't know. You know, you watch people do things and you interpret them in different ways, but the way I saw that, it was just quite humble. I just felt that was a guy realising what he achieved, but it wasn't somebody thinking I was brilliant. It was like, even though the goal was brilliant and you would have been well within your rights to have kind of given it the big I am, but it was just more gratitude, it looked to me. And I just thought that was really touching. And, you know, I know that there was a good stat I saw on the internet talking about how 75%, let me just double check this, 75% of matches in the top two flights this weekend, had a former Chelsea Academy player feature. So, you know, there's a product line of players, no doubt about it. We know how much, but we also know how hard it is for any of those players to eventually play for the club that they tend to have been associated with for the majority of their lives. So for that, for Chalabar, who is one of those ones, you know, the customary, here's a picture of me and Mason Mount when we were, you know, knee-high to a grasshopper. But he had not come anywhere near making that breakthrough up until this point. And, you know, he looked to the manner born. He had a very effective defensive performance as well as the goal and played well in the Super Cup too. And we know that, you know, we've seen Fikayo Tomori do something similar, come into the team a couple of seasons ago, and then, you know, 18 months later, he's gone. So it's not the end of the journey, but it was really, I do think it was a very nice moment.
Hmm. In that photo, Mason Mount is knee high to a grasshopper. Chalabar looked like he was already 6 foot, to be fair, didn't he? But yeah, had a great game. Alonso's free kick was absolutely beautiful. Crystal Palace, Barry, I mean, they didn't, you know, we don't want to read too much into one game. They didn't have a sniff, did they?
Nah, they were pretty poor against a very good team. I don't think they mustered anything in the way of a shot on goal until well after the hour mark. And, I'm not going to judge them on that performance, but some of their players did not distinguish themselves at all.
Chelsea have completed the signing of Lukaku. Mike says, now that Chelsea have finally landed him, where's he going on loan first? And Zozia says, do you think Timo will improve with Rom alongside him? Give a girl some hope. I adore Timo. I'd hate to see him benched. I think Werner's really key alongside him. I don't know what you think, Wilson. I think that paid.
Yeah,
I think
Lukaku's movement and physicality and intelligence will create chances for Werner. And I think the fact he's not the sort of designated main goal scorer will probably help him. That he can sort of go under the radar a bit because, you know, if you're a wide player and you score 5 goals in a season, well, that's fine. But I suspect he will get 10, 15, 20. Okay, 10, 15. while Lukaku kind of, you know, gets comfortably, you know, over 20.
Everton 3, Southampton 1. Rafa got a lovely reception, Barry, didn't he? And one win over Southampton, and all of history is forgotten.
It's probably a bit early to say that. The history will be remembered once results start going against them. And that's, I suppose, the key question. Can Everton achieve some sort of consistency by stringing several wins together? I mean, they did so at the start of last season. I think there were 6 or 7 unbeaten in all competitions, and they ended up going over a cliff. Their home form was dismal, but that's a very good win against a Southampton team I'd be slightly concerned about. I'd also be concerned about poor old Richarlison, who played all last season, played in the Copa America, got to the final, played in the Olympics, got to the final. That was only a week ago, and now he's back scoring and assisting for Everton in this game. Is he going to get any sort of break? Because when he came to Watford first, he didn't get off to a flyer because he had just played an entire Brazilian league season and a tournament before that as well. So, I'd be a little worried about how long he'll be able to keep motoring before he runs out of gas. But very impressive performance against pretty limited opposition.
Decore's strike was fun, wasn't it? Tried to control it about 5 times and thought, I can't be bothered to control this. I'll just kick it as hard as I can. Calvert-Lewin diving header as well.
Which is very reminiscent of the Andy Gray goal against Sunderland in 84-5, the famous one from the Peter Reid cross.
Although, as I said to Barry yesterday, it was a beautiful goal, but the keeper should have let it go in.
Yeah.
Because if the keeper gets too much and it doesn't really hit the back of the net, it just doesn't feel quite as good to me. I mean, it's probably worth the same number of goals, but in many ways, it shouldn't be. Adam Armstrong was assisted by Che Adams. No Stuart Armstrong involved in the goal, but we did get this tweet from Simon, who said, following the talk on Thursday's pod about the commentary opportunities for Southampton, Adam Armstrong, surely this is trumped by the QPR team of 2014, who had Young, Much and Dunn, where we could potentially hear Dunn too much, Much too young, which I enjoyed tremendously. Tony says, do you think, Max, that you and Barry combined could neutralise and take down a frenzied, naked Duncan Ferguson in open combat?
No, we couldn't.
It's not a chance. I'm interested to know, Tony, if you could give us some background to how this has all happened and the scenario. You know, I'm not saying we'll reenact it or try and make it happen. It would be a strange call to Duncan, but no, I comfortably feel like Barry and I would run away.
Yeah,
and I also comfortably feel that I would get away if it was it was me and Barry running away.
Well, you don't have to be faster than Big Dunk. You only have to be faster than me, and you
yeah.
are.
A couple more games. Burnley 1, Brighton 2. Appeared to be, from the highlights, very much a game of two halves, and the all-new beard of Graham Potter winning it with two substitutions, Wilson.
Yeah, I'm not sure that Burnley goal should have stood. I mean, I get annoyed by blocking players at corners, but I'm not really sure you're allowed to just sort of dump an opponent on the ground and get away with it. But yeah, Brighton looked very vulnerable to Burnley's aerial threat, but the two substitutions in the second half changed it completely. So,
Mike Rigg says, "Hi guys, I'm more than happy to provide an interesting Burnley fact. Burnley are the only Premier League team able to field a starting 11 with each player wearing the correct squad number corresponding to position. Example of correct number in traditional 4-4-2, 5 and 6 centre-back, 4 and 8 centre-mids. Pope, Loughton, Tarkowski, Mead, Taylor, Goodmanson, Brownhill, Cork, McNeil, Wood, Barnes. This reflects the organised slash dull style of our team, which will inevitably prove you all wrong, finish 15th, thanks to 12 goals from Chris Wood." Thank you, Mike Rigg. He's, I'd say, spot on about all of it. To the King Power, Leicester 1, Wolves 0. And look, Paul, that finish from Jamie Vardy is just exceptional, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, when's that guy going to slow up? I mean, didn't he retire from international football about 5 years ago? And he's still, well, that's not true, is it? Three. But I mean, in order to preserve his body, and that body is still very much preserved. I think it wasn't a great game. And, you know, there were, I think Adama had an opportunity that he probably should have put away that would have put a different gloss on it. But that looked like, from sort of semi distance, to be an effective control performance from a team who will be competing near the top of the table without really busting a gut to get there.
Hmm. And it was a nice turn from Pereira, but technically that Vardy finish is exceptional, isn't it? Look, that'll do for part two. Part three, we will look back at the life of Gert Müller. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's talk about Gert Müller, Bayern Munich, West Germany, heroic striker, World Cup winner, 566 goals in 607 games for Bayern, extraordinary record, 68 goals in 62 for West Germany. In 1972, he scored 85 goals in 60 games. Wilson, he was an amazing footballer, wasn't he?
Yeah, and I think there's, because he had one sort of super gift. Yeah, his poaching is extraordinary. I think there's a tendency to slightly underrate him as a footballer. So he scored 14 goals across two World Cups, so 10 in 1974 and 1974. And of those 14 goals, one was a penalty. One was from just slightly further back from the penalty spot, where he, against Poland in 74, the only goal in that game, which was a second phase group game against a very, very good Poland, where he just sort of latched onto a sort of half clearance, but every other goal is from within 12 yards. I think five of his goals in 1970, so half his goals in 1970 are inside the 6 yard box. So I watched those 14 goals this morning, and he was a fantastic header of a ball. But the thing he's really famous for is his ability to turn very sharply. Had a very low center of gravity. So when he turns up at Bayern, Zlatko Tchaikovsky, the Bayern coach, sort of, "Why have you given me a weightlifter?" Yeah, the body shape was all wrong, because he had these. Stettmeier, I think, said he had thighs as big as Stettmeier's waist. But that's. And Tchaikovsky also called him Kleines Dickes Müller, short, fat Müller. But he's not short and fat at all, actually, if you look at him. He's sort of average height, average build, apart from his massive thighs. But it meant he's very hard to knock over. He could spin very quickly. And I think his finishing. I mean, this might be an over-romanticized story, but he grew up in a place called Nördlingen on a cobbled street, and he used to play endlessly on the cobbles. And so the theory is that because the ball was sort of bouncing all over off the cobbles, he was very good at directing it, even after a weird bounce. So if you think of his goal in the 74 World Cup final, and the ball comes in from the right, and it's very hard to tell whether his first touch, whether he means it, whether it's a bad touch, but I can't remember who the Dutch defender is, he's completely thrown by it. And suddenly he's just able to then poke it past Jongbloed, which is, I think, is an example of his ability to react to odd bounces of the ball. So I'd sort of gone through life just assuming he was just a great poacher. And then I actually watched the game in 1972 when West Germany beat England 3-1 at Wembley. And he's brilliant playing as a sort of link forward in that game. Really good with his back to goal. And he's involved in the play, not just in the six-yard box, but yeah, everywhere in the England half. So I think he was a very gifted all-round footballer. He was an absolutely brilliant finisher and poacher. Yeah, Franz Beckenbauer says he wasn't anywhere near the most gifted player in those West Germany or Bayern sides. You know, so he won a World Cup and a European Championship. He won three European Cups with Bayern. But Beckenbauer said, yeah, he was the most important player because he could nick anything from anywhere, and he capitalised on the good build-up play. And then, you know, he retires very young from international football. He's only 28. And I'm not sure that was ever fully explained. But then he went to the US, played for Fort Lauderdale Strikers, retired in 82, and very quickly fell into depression and alcoholism. Really struggled. Bayern did a lot to help him out. They got him treatment. They gave him a job initially, sort of greeting visitors at the training ground and at the stadium. And then he became a scout, and then he became a coach. He was actually a big early influence on Thomas Müller, who, you know, no relation. But then it became apparent that things were not great. In 2015, it was acknowledged he had Alzheimer's, and I think he's pretty much been bedbound for the last year. So his 75th birthday was last November. Bayern had a huge event where, you know, Beckenbauer and Meyer and people said all these lovely things about him, but he couldn't be there.
Gert Müller, who has passed away at the age of 75.
And also, just sort of, I know we've got this, somebody's found this clip of me on the University Challenge, which for some reason you think is important enough to talk about. I think it's the second round you found the clip of, the first round. So this is 1998. I was wearing a Gert Müller shirt.
Yeah, this is it.
It's some kind of idea of what a significant player he was in my sort of footballing upbringing.
Sean said, yes, by some freak accident, which he doesn't go into, I accidentally came across a University Challenge episode with Jonathan Wilson on it. The first question is about football, and he doesn't get it. Would any of the other panellists have been successful? The question is, which footballer nicknamed Giraffe won 35 caps for England during his long career with Leeds United?
Christ, I'm writing a book on him. Jesus Christ.
You have to buzz in. McInnes Norwich.
Alan Smith.
No, you lose 5 points. Do you want to buzz in,
Barry? You of all people.
Oh, God.
I knew it. I got it before.
I can't believe I didn't. I'd completely forgotten that.
I don't know.
I am literally writing a book about this man now.
It's Jack Charlton.
Oh, Christ.
Yeah. You should all be ashamed. But no, I got it. I got it about the same speed as your captain. Got it. Tim writes, Dear Max, congratulations on the new job. I too am a souvenir of my wife's time in the UK. 21 years later, I have two Australian teenagers and a Kelpie. Barry is right. There is no going back. I am writing to propose an Australian amendment to the Glendenning rule on replica shirts. Wearing a replica shirt in Australia is a great way to make friends. Expats, depending on allegiances, will either gently rib you or reminisce about a great time for your club. Aussies love sharing the backstory of why they support their club. I think Barry should allow grown men to wear replica shirts any time in Australia. It was only last week, wearing my black replica Liverpool top, out of date, but not old enough to be retro, that I got into a conversation with The Butcher on the likely outcome of Sheffield Wednesday's upcoming season. You will be alone and friendless in this big brown land. I recommend wearing a replica shirt any time the current Mrs. Rushton will allow. Yours from the lockdown northern beaches of Sydney. Barry, do you allow this?
I'm have no problem whatsoever. Well, I do have a problem with it, but I'm not about to dictate what anyone should be allowed wear. People can wear what they want. I will, you know, look at them with disdain if I feel they deserve it, but, you know, otherwise have at it.
I suppose it depends if I want to have a conversation with The Butcher about Sheffield Wednesday's chances this season. I feel like I do quite a lot of talking about football right there. I'll just want some sausages. Can we congratulate, finally, Alexandra B. Rivard, who tweeted, "Good news, des bonnes nouvelles. I successfully defended my dissertation." He then thanked his colleagues, his wife, his co-supervisors, his examination committee. And then he said, "Other completely random people I need to thank are non-academics who provided me with necessary distractions and humor. Barry, Max, and the Seattle Mariners, obviously." So in many ways, Barry, we've either earned ourselves a PhD, or he wouldn't have got this PhD without us. And without leaving our houses, we are now experts in political parties, Quebec, independence movements, and Canadian politics.
Fair enough. So can I call myself a doctor now, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. Dr. Glenn Denning. Congratulations. Very well done. You were excellent. And that was your viva. Today's pod was your viva, and you passed, Barry.
I don't even know what that means.
That's fine. that'll do for today's pod. Paul, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Max.
Cheers, Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
We'll be back with the Europod on Wednesday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.